The universe is made of stories, not atoms. These words from poet Muriel Rukeyser remind us that the stories that we tell ourselves and each other are how we make sense of the world and our place in it. Some of these stories are so close, so intimate, so much a part of our flesh and bone that it's hard for us to even see them. In the words of writer Maria Popova, some stories are so sticky, so pervasive, that we internalize them to a point where we no longer see their storiness. They become not one of many lenses on reality, but reality itself. I imagine this is how it was for Saul, who we read about in Acts 9. He has a story that is so close, so intimate, so much a part of his flesh and his bone, that it's hard for him to imagine or even acknowledge another reality. Saul's story begins in modern-day Turkey in at a city called Tarsus, where he was born probably around the year AD 5. His Jewish parents are Roman citizens, and so he's granted this privilege as well. And it seems that when he's a young child, his whole family picks up and moves to Jerusalem. Between the ages of 10 and 15, it seems that Paul begins his studies at the feet of a well-known rabbi that we hear about throughout the book of Acts, a rabbi by the name of Gamaliel. Saul's faith formation steeps him deeply in the story of his people, the history that has shaped them, the covenant law that guides them, the passions that pulse through their veins. Saul is an earnest student. He learns this precious story well. He breathes it, it courses through his body and his soul, and he emerges with passion and zeal. Unfortunately, this zeal leads him to carry out a systematic campaign of terror against a group of people who are living a very different story. People who in Acts 9 are referred to as followers of the way. These are followers of Jesus. Now, according to the framework of Saul's story, this new, this emerging, this radical Jewish movement is not only heretical, it is blasphemous. Its followers claim the lordship of a crucified Messiah. And I think it's probably hard for us to understand how audacious and blasphemous this claim would have sounded to those ears. Saul's response is to take it upon himself to defend his God against all who would threaten his God's integrity. His defense is fierce. In Acts 8, we find him in Jerusalem, giving his blessing to the stoning of Stephen, and then conducting home raids on suspected followers of Jesus, having them arrested and hauled off to jail. As a result of this brutal persecution, the church in Jerusalem actually scatters. It scatters throughout the countryside of Judea and Samaria. And even that's not enough for Saul. This morning, we see him headed for Damascus, a Syrian city and a major trade center about 135 miles north of Jerusalem. With murder on his breath, as the text describes it, Saul goes there to hunt down followers of the way and to bring them back to Jerusalem in chains. Saul was not a nice man. But in all fairness, he was doing what he believed in his heart was right. He was living out his precious story with great passion and with great conviction. And with great loyalty, to the degree that there was no room for any other story. Now, in the same part of the world where Saul lived, 2,000 years later, other stories are being lived out. And when our learning tour group was in Israel-Palestine this past November, we had the privilege of hearing some of those stories. One afternoon, we heard the story of a Jewish rabbi by the name of Hanan Schlesinger. We met with him in his home in the Jewish settlement of Alon Shavuot. Hanan's story begins in Brooklyn, New York, where he was born and raised. At the age of 20, he emigrated to Israel, where he met and married his wife, Ayala. He finished college. He went on to immerse himself in Jewish studies at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he became a rabbi. All along the way, he was steeped in the story of his people. The rich and painful, incredibly painful history that has shaped them. The covenant law that guides them. The passions that pulse through their veins, including their deep connection with the land, what they would call the land of Canaan. Hanan has been an earnest student. He has learned this precious story well. He breathes it. It courses through his body and soul, and it emerges with passion and with zeal. And in his own words, "This story blinded me for 35 years. For 35 years, I couldn't see that there were other stories. Palestinians were invisible to me." Saul's story, Hanan's story, our stories. Sometimes our stories are so sticky, so pervasive, so much a part of our flesh and bones that we no longer see their storiness. They become not one of many lenses on reality, but reality itself. But once in a while, once in a great while, if we are lucky, something or someone enters our lives, usually uninvited, and cracks us open in a way that helps us see our stories in new light. Saul gets lucky on his road trip to Damascus. Along the way, he is struck by a blinding brilliance that knocks him to the ground. Through this intervention and a brief conversation with a voice from heaven, Saul hears and comes to understand that this story, this precious story that clings to him, has been leading him in the wrong direction. There is another story out there, authored by his very own God, that challenges his most basic assumptions about the world and his place in it, about his God, his faith, his calling. This realization shakes him to the core. It rattles his foundation and completely disorients him, leaving him without sight. Hanan gets lucky on a journey that begins right at the edge of his own neighborhood. He writes about this experience in his blog post, Journey Towards the Other, and I would like to tell this story in his own words. He writes, 22 months ago, I opened the front door of my apartment in Alon Shavuot and took a 20-minute walk that began to change my life. My wife asked me to please reconsider. It might be dangerous, she said. You might not come back alive. But I went anyway. My heart beat just a little bit faster than usual as I walked through the Arab fields and vineyards that surround my home in the Judean hills. Just a few days earlier, I'd sat in my living room with a Protestant pastor from the United States, actually from West Virginia, who had come to the Holy Land in order to meet Palestinians, meet Israeli settlers, and then introduce them to each other. He listened to my story of biblical Zionism and of passionate connection to the rebuilding of Jewish life in the biblical heartland. He heard of my identification with our forefather Abraham and with Isaac and Jacob and the whole panorama of Jewish history. And then he invited me to a little gathering on a Palestinian farm plot where Palestinians and Israeli settlers might be able to begin to get to know each other. Never before had I met a Palestinian as an equal. Never before had I socialized with one or broken bread with one. I knew nothing about them. We live so close to each other, truly in each other's backyards. And yet, we are so far apart. For us, the Palestinians are the consummate other, the other you ignore, that you never see, the other that you would never give a ride to, the other that you would never invite into your home, the other from whom you are completely distant, the other of whom you are thoroughly suspicious. For 3 hours or more, I chatted with them and ate with them. I looked into their faces from up close and saw, despite my prejudices, human faces. And I heard stories that were so different from my stories. Stories that created strange, unfamiliar narratives from the same building blocks as my own narrative, which I could not reject out of hand. The stories I heard of deep connection to the land, of suffering, of humiliation, of loved ones lost in conflict, they were authentic. They were real. Never before had I heard such stories, and they affected me deeply. As it began to get dark, and there were about 25 or 30 of us left, we sat around in a circle and heard the life story of Ali Abu Awad, former militant turned nonviolent peace activist. He spoke of nocturnal night raids by the Israeli military, of rights denied, of prison, and I knew it was true. I had suppressed my memories of participating in those raids and guarding those prisoners decades ago as a young soldier, and it all came back to me, flooding my consciousness. Ali's reality made its way into my heart, and I will never be the same. His truth has not made mine any less true. Rather, it has shown my truth to be only a part of this complex web of the reality in which we live. My life has become so much more complicated as I hold within my consciousness two conflicting truths that are both valid. Loose ends are dangling within me. I have become much more fragmented, yet much more whole. As I embrace more and more partial truths, my horizons expand in the direction of the infinite one, within whom all truths find their proper place. Now, I sincerely doubt that Saul or Hanan felt lucky as these new and disturbing stories cracked open their ways of seeing and thinking and interpreting the world around them. Saul was left shaken and blind. He needed to be held by the hand and led into Damascus. He couldn't find the way on his own. He was so affected that for 3 days he couldn't eat or drink. Hanan describes the soul-searching and penitence that resulted from his profound encounter as the most intense and paradigm-shattering I have ever experienced. The experience thrust him into a deep spiritual and existential crisis that lasted for many months. Yet, in the end, Saul and Hanan both emerge from their foundation-shaking encounters with fuller vision, new direction, and a far richer story about the world and their place in it. What I find maybe most interesting of all is that they were led into this space not by close friends and allies. They were led into this space by people they had each considered their enemy. Ananias, a follower of Jesus and one that was very likely on Saul's hit list, is prompted to go to Saul and minister to him. Against his better judgment, he has an argument with God about this. He ends up going. And as Saul opens himself to Ananias' care, the healing begins. Saul regains his sight. He commits himself to a new spiritual path, and he embraces a new community. As a result of his encounter, Hanan also commits himself to a new spiritual path as he embraces a new community. His new community has become an organization called Roots, which is a network of local Palestinians and Israelis who have come to see themselves and have come to see each other as the partners that they need to make changes toward ending the conflict between their people. Hanan currently dedicates much of his time and energy to the work of Roots, and I'm not really quite sure how his family feels about it. But he does. He spends his time and energy there seeking to provide a very rare, safe space for Palestinians and Israelis to come together, to learn each other's stories and languages, to share differing perspectives, to build trust and a shared vision for what could be together. Now, you need to know that Hanan is still a Zionist. At least I think he would still call himself that. He still lives in a Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank. And he knows his world must change. And so he does perhaps the small thing that he knows he can do. He lives out a new commitment to move toward the other, to acknowledge the common humanity in the other, to build bridges and partnerships with the other. And in so doing, he opens his own story to a radical reshaping. Who knows what his story will look like 10 years from now? In the meantime, an ocean away from Saul and Hanan, we live, we breathe our own stories. Precious stories that course through our bodies and souls, that emerge from us with passion and with zeal. Stories that shape our lives, as well they should, as we embrace them as gift. And sometimes the stories that come to us as gift impede our journey of loving God and neighbor with all that we are. sometimes they impede us. We hit a roadblock when we hold on to our precious stories so tightly that there is precious little room for other stories that are seeking voice among us. We hit a roadblock when our stories, particularly our stories of privilege, are so sticky, so pervasive, so internalized that they blind us to the stories of those who see and experience the world in a very, very different way. I find myself thinking an awful lot about stories these days, about the many rich and incredibly painful stories that I heard in Israel and Palestine that I continue to process, the stories of racism in our country that are being brought to light and being exposed for what they are, the stories of people far from home seeking refuge and safety here in our own community, the stories held in our wider church that, instead of being shared openly and vulnerably, are often talked around. And I think about the sacred stories that are held here in this community that I am privileged to hear from you on a daily basis. I think about these stories. I ponder these stories. I hold them in my heart. And it occurs to me, as I do, that our work as followers of Jesus seeking to embody his love, it begins simply with this, with an invitation to open our hearts to the story of the other, whoever the other may be, and to open ourselves to the ongoing process of conversion along the way. Now, opening ourselves to conversion will require ongoing effort. It's not a once-and-done deal. We will need to seek out stories that we aren't used to hearing, stories that we've never heard before. We will need to seek out voices that have been silent, or perhaps silenced. We will need to seek out narratives that reside on the margins of our congregation. And yes, there are stories that reside on the margins of our congregation, in our community, in our world. And then we will need to get quiet and listen. To listen for what is said and also for what is not said. As we hear stories of marginalization, to listen for our stories of privilege embedded within them. This is hard work. This is really hard work because it is heart work. It is heart stretching, sometimes heart wrenching, hopefully heart expanding work. And even when these stories disturb us more than comfort us, we keep listening. Because these are the stories. These are the stories that have the power to change us. They have the power to change us precisely because they challenge the stories that we hold dear. They have the power to change us because they ask us to stretch our hearts wide and wider still to embrace those who see and experience the world in different ways. They have the power to change us because they draw us deeper into the heart of God's story, which at its core is a story full of love, of liberation, healing, justice, and reconciliation for all people, everywhere. In the end, this is a big story that sets us free from the nearsightedness of the many small stories that inhabit and seek to dominate our world. This is the big story that holds each and every one of our precious stories in love and is always making room for more. May we immerse ourselves in the story full of a love that is far bigger than we can ever imagine. And may we trust the one who continues to author this story through us. Amen.